that the governor lived. They had been my friends, Ann and Adam. Adam and I had fished and sailed all over that end of the Gulf of Mexico, and Ann, who was big-eyed and quiet-faced and thin, had been with us, close and never saying a word. Adam and I had hunted and camped all over the country, and Ann had been there, a thin-legged little girl about 4 years younger than we were. And we had sat by the fire in the Stanton house, or in my house, and had played with toys or read books while Ann sat there. Then after a long time, Ann wasn't a little girl anymore. She was a big girl, and I was so much in love with her that I lived in a dream. In that dream, my heart seemed to be ready to burst, for it seemed that the whole world was inside it, swelling to get out and be the world. But that summer came to an end. Time passed, and nothing happened that we had felt so certain at one time would happen. So now Ann was an old maid living in the city, and even if she did look pretty good yet and wore clothes that didn't hurt her any, her laugh was getting brittle, and there was a drawn look on her face as though she were trying to remember something. What was Ann trying to remember? Well, I didn't have to try to remember. I could remember, but I didn't want to remember. If the human race didn't remember anything, it would be perfectly happy. I was a student of history once in a university, and if I learned anything from studying history, that was what I learned, or to be more exact, that was what I thought I had learned. We would go down the row, the line of houses facing the bay, and that was the place where all my pals had been. Anne, who was an old maid, or damn near it. Adam, who was a famous surgeon, and who was nice to me but didn't go fishing with me anymore. And Judge Irwin, who lived in the last house, and who had been a friend of my family, and who used to take me hunting with him, and taught me to shoot, and taught me to ride, and read history to me from leather-bound books in the big study in his house. After Ellis Burden went away, he was more of a father to me than those men who had married my mother and come to live in Ellis Burden's house. And the judge was a man. So I told Sugar Boy how to get through town and to the row where all my pals lived or had lived. We pulled through the town, where the lights were out except for the bulbs hanging from the telephone poles, and on out the bay road where the houses were bone white back among the magnolias and live oaks. At night, you pass through a little town where you once lived, and you expect to see yourself wearing knee pants, standing all alone on the street corner under the hanging bulbs, where the bugs bang on the tin reflectors and splatter to the pavement to lie stunned. You expect to see that boy standing there under the street lamp, out too late, and you feel like telling him he ought to go on home to bed or there will be hell to pay. But maybe you are home in bed and sound asleep and not dreaming, and nothing has ever happened that seems to have happened. But then, who the hell is this in the back seat of the big black Cadillac that comes ghosting through the town? Why, this is Jack Burden. Don't you remember little Jack Burden? He used to go out in his boat in the afternoon on the bay to fish, and come home and eat his supper and kiss his beautiful mother good night, and say his prayers and go to bed at 9:30. Oh, you mean old Ellis Burden's boy? Yeah, and that woman he married out of Texas, or was it Arkansas? That big-eyed, thin-faced woman who lives up there in that old Burden place now with that man she got herself. Whatever happened to Ellis Burden? Hell, I don't know. Nobody around here had any word going on years. He was a queer un. Damn if he wasn't queer, going off and leaving a real looker like that woman out of Arkansas. Maybe he couldn't give her what she craved. Well, he gave her that boy, that Jack Burden. Yeah. You come into the town at night, and there are the voices. We had got to the end of the row, and I saw the house, bone white, back among the dark oak boughs. Here it is, I said. Park out here, the boss said. And then to me, there's a light. The bugger ain't in bed. You go on and knock on the door and tell him I want to see him. Suppose he won't open up? He will, the boss said. But if he won't, you make him. What the hell do I pay you for? I got out of the car and went in the gate and started up the shell walk under the black trees. Then I heard the boss coming after me. We went up the walk with him just behind me and up the gallery steps. The boss stood to one side and I pulled open the screen and knocked on the door. I knocked again, Then looking in through the glass by the door, I saw a door open off the hall, where the library was, I remembered. Then a side light come on in the hall. He was coming to the door. I could see him through the glass while he fumbled with the lock.
"Yes?"
he asked. "Good evening, Judge," I said. He stood there blinking into the dark outside, trying to make out my face. "It's Jack Burden," I said.
"Well, well, Jack. Well, I'll be jiggered."
And he put out his hand.
"Come in."
He even looked glad to see me. I shook hands and stepped inside, where the mirrors in the peeling gold frames glimmered on the walls in the rays of the not-bright side light, and the glass of the big hurricane lamps glimmered on the marble-topped stands.
"What can I do for you, Jack?"
he asked me, and gave me a look out of his yellow eyes. They hadn't changed much, even if the rest of him had. "Well," I began, and didn't know how I was going to end. "I just wanted to see if you were up and could talk to..."
"Sure, Jack, come on in. You aren't in any trouble, son. Let me shut the door first, and..."
He turned to shut the door, and if his ticker hadn't been in good shape for all his near 80, he'd have dropped dead, for the boss was standing there in the door. He hadn't made a sound. As it was, the judge didn't drop dead, and his face didn't show a thing, but I felt him stiffen. You turn to shut a door some night and find somebody standing there out of the dark, and you'll take a jump, too.
"No," the boss said, easy and grinning, taking his hat off his head and stepping inside just as though he'd been invited, which he hadn't been. "No, Jack isn't in any trouble, not that I know of, nor me either."
The judge was looking at me now.
"I beg your pardon," he said to me,
in a voice he knew how to make cold and rasping, like an old phonograph needle scraping on an old record.
"I had forgotten for the moment how well your needs are provided for." "Oh, Jack's making out," the boss said. "And you, sir?"
The judge turned on the boss and slanted his yellow eyes down on him, for he was a half a head taller, and I could see the jaw muscles twitch and knot under the folds of red, rusty, and seamed skin on his long jaw.
"Do you wish to say something to me?"
"Well, I don't know as I do," the boss remarked offhand.
"Not at the moment."
"Well," the judge said, "in that case..."
"Oh, something might develop," the boss broke in. "You never can tell if we get the weight off our arches."
"In that case," the judge resumed, and it was an old needle and an old record, and it was scraping like a file on cold tin and nothing human. "I may say that I was about to retire."
"Oh, it's early yet," the boss said,
and took his time giving Judge Irwin the once-over from head to toe. The judge was wearing an old-fashioned velvet smoking jacket and tuxedo pants and a boiled shirt, but he had taken off his collar and tie, and the gold collar button was shining just under the big old red Adam's apple.
"Yeah," the boss went on, after he'd finished the once-over, "and you'll sleep better if you wait before going to bed and give that fine dinner you had a chance to digest."
And he just began walking down the hall toward the door where the light was, the door to the library. Judge Irwin looked at the boss's back as the boss just walked away, the Palm Beach coat all crumpled up where it had crawled on the boss's shoulders, and the old sweat stains of the afternoon showing dark at the armpits. The judge's yellow eyes were near to popping out of his face, and the blood was up in his face till it was the color of calf's liver in a butcher shop. Then he began to walk down the hall after the boss. I followed the pair of them. The boss was already sitting in a big old scuffed leather easy chair when I went in. I stood there against the wall, under the bookshelves that went up to the ceiling, full of old leather books, a lot of them law books, that got lost in the shadows up above and made the room smell musty like old cheese. Well, the room hadn't changed any. I could remember that smell from the long afternoons I had spent in that room, reading by myself or hearing the judge's voice reading to me, while a log crackled on the hearth and the clock in the corner, a big grandfather's clock, offered us the slow, small, individual pellets of time. It was the same room. There were the big steel engravings on the wall,
By Piranesi, in the heavy scrollwork frames, the Tiber, the Colosseum, some ruined temple. And the riding crops on the mantel and on the desk, and the silver cups the judge's dogs had won in the field trials, and the judge had won shooting. The gun rack, over in the shadow by the door, was out of the light from the big brass reading lamp on the desk, but I knew every gun in it, and knew the gun's feel. The judge didn't sit down. He stood in the middle of the floor and looked down at the boss, who had his legs stuck out on the red carpet. And the judge didn't say anything. Something was going on inside his head. You knew that if he had a little glass window in the side of that tall skull, where the one-time thick, dark red, mane-like hair was thinned out now and faded, you could see inside and see the wheels and springs and cogs and ratchets working away and shining like a beautiful lot of well-kept mechanism. But maybe somebody had pushed the wrong button. Maybe it was just going to run on and on till something cracked or the spring ran down, and nothing was going to happen. But the boss said something. He jerked his head sideways to indicate the silver tray with the bottle and the pitcher of water, and a silver bowl and two used glasses and three or four clean ones which sat on the desk, and said, "Judge, I trust you don't mind Jack pouring me a slug. You know, Southern hospitality." Judge Irwin didn't answer him. He turned to me and said, "I didn't realize, Jack, that your duties included those of a body servant, but of course, if I am mistaken..." I could have slapped his face. I could have slapped that goddamned, handsome, eagle-beaked, strong-boned, rubiginous-hided, high-old face, in which the eyes weren't old, but were hard and bright without any depth to them, and were an insult to look into. And the boss laughed, and I could have slapped his goddamned face. I could have walked right out and left the two of them there, alone in that cheese-smelling room together till hell froze over, and just kept on walking. But I didn't, and perhaps it was just as well, for maybe you cannot ever really walk away from the things you want most to walk away from. "Oh, nuts," the boss said and stopped laughing, and heaved himself up out of the leather chair and made a pass at the bottle and sloshed out some whiskey into a glass and poured in some water. Then he turned round and, grinning up to the judge, stepped toward me and held out the glass. "Here, Jack," he said, "have a drink." I can't say that I took the drink. It got shoved into my hand and I stood there holding it, not drinking it, and watched the boss look up at Judge Irwin and say, "Sometimes Jack pours me a drink, and sometimes I pour him a drink, and..." He stepped toward the desk again. "Sometimes I pour myself a drink." He poured the drink, added water, and looked again at the judge, leering with a kind of comic cunning. "Whether I'm asked or not," he said, and added, "There's lots of things you never get, Judge, if you wait till you're asked. And I am an impatient man. I am a very impatient man, Judge. That is why I am not a gentleman, Judge." "Really?" replied the judge. He stood in the middle of the floor and studied the scene beneath him. From my spot by the wall, I looked at both of them. To hell with them, I thought. To hell with both of them. When they talked like that, it was to hell with both of them. "Yeah," the boss was saying, "you're a gent, and so you don't ever get impatient, not even for your liquor. You aren't even impatient for your drink right now, and it's liquor your money paid for. But you'll get a drink, Judge. I'm asking you to have one. Have a drink with me, Judge." Judge Irwin didn't answer a word. He stood very erect in the middle of the floor. "Oh, have a drink," the boss said and laughed, and sat again in the big chair and stuck out his legs on the red carpet. The judge didn't pour himself a drink, and he didn't sit down. The boss looked up at him from the chair and said, "Judge, you happen to have an evening paper around here?" The paper was lying over on another chair by the fireplace, with the judge's collar and tie on top of it, and his white jacket hung on the back of the chair. I saw the judge's eyes snap over there to it and then back at the boss. "Yes," the judge said,
As a matter of fact, I have.
I haven't had a chance to see one rushing around the country today. Mind if I take a look?
Not in the slightest, Judge Irwin said, and the sound was the file scraping on that cold tin again. But perhaps I can relieve your curiosity on one point. The paper publishes my endorsement of Callahan for the Senate nomination, if that is of interest to you.
Just wanted to hear you say it, Judge. Somebody told me, but you know how rumor hath a thousand tongues, and how the newspaper boys tend to exaggeration and the truth ain't in 'em.
There was no exaggeration in this case, the judge said.
Just wanted to hear you say it, with your own silver tongue.
Well, you've heard it, the judge said, standing straight in the middle of the floor. And in that case, at your leisure.
The judge's face was the color of calf's liver again, even if the words did come out cold and spaced.
If you have finished your drink.
Why, thanks, Judge, the boss said, sweet as chess pie. I reckon I will take another spot.
And he heaved himself in the direction of the bottle. He did his work and said,
thanks.
When he was back in the leather chair with the fresh load in the glass, he said,
Yeah, Judge, I've heard you say it, but I just wanted to hear you say something else. Are you sure you took it to the Lord in prayer? Huh?
I have settled the matter in my own mind, the judge said.
Well, if I recollect right,
the boss ruminatively turned the glass in his hands,
back in town when we had our little talk, you sort of felt my boy Masters was all right.
I made no commitment, the judge said sharply. I didn't make any commitment except to my conscience.
You've been messing in politics a long time, Judge, the boss said, easy. And,
he took a drag from the glass,
so has your conscience.
I beg your pardon, the judge snapped.
Nuts, the boss said and grinned. But what got you off Masters?
Certain features of his career came to my attention.
Somebody dug up some dirt for you, huh?
If you choose to call it that, the judge said.
Dirt's a funny thing, the boss said. Come to think of it, there ain't a thing but dirt on this green God's globe except what's underwater, and that's dirt, too. It's dirt makes the grass grow. A diamond ain't a thing in the world but a piece of dirt that got awful hot, and God Almighty picked up a handful of dirt and blew on it and made you and me and George Washington and mankind blessed in faculty and apprehension. It all depends on what you do with the dirt. That right?
That doesn't alter the fact,
the judge said from way up there where his head was, above the rays of the desk lamp,
that Masters doesn't strike me as a responsible man.
He better be responsible, the boss said. Or I'll break his goddamn neck.
That's the trouble. Masters would be responsible to you.
It's a fact,
the boss admitted ruefully, lifting his face under the light and shaking his head in fatalistic sadness.
Masters would be responsible to me. I can't help it. But Callahan, now take Callahan. It sort of seems to me he's going to be responsible to you and Alta Power and God knows who else before he's through. And what's the difference, huh?
Well, hell.
The boss popped straight up in the chair with that inner explosiveness he had when all of a sudden he would snatch a fly out of the air or whip his head at you and his eyes would snap open. He popped up and his heels dug into the red carpet. Some of the liquor sloshed out of his glass onto his Palm Beach pants.
Well, I'll tell you the difference, Judge. I can deliver Masters, and you can't deliver Callahan, and that's a big difference.
I'll have to take my chance, the judge said from way up there.
Chance?
And the boss laughed.
Judge, he said and quit laughing, you haven't got but one chance. You've been guessing right in this state going on 40 years. You've been sitting back here in this room, and nigger boys been single-footing in here bringing you toddies, and you've been guessing right. You've been sitting back here and grinning to yourself while the rest of them were out sweating on the stump and snapping their suspenders, and when you wanted anything, you just reached out and took it. Oh, if you had a little time off from duck hunting and corporation law, you might do a hitch as attorney general. So you did. Or play at being a judge. You've been a judge a long time. How would it feel not to be a judge anymore?
No man, Judge Irwin said and stood up there straight in the middle of the floor, has ever been able to intimidate me.
Well, I never tried, the boss said,
yet.
And I'm not trying now. I'm going to give you a chance. You say somebody gave you some dirt on Masters? Well, just suppose I gave you some dirt on Callahan.
Oh, don't interrupt. Keep your shirt on.
And he held up his hand.
I haven't been doing any digging, but I might. And if I went out in the barn lot and stuck my shovel in and brought you in some of the sweet-smelling and put it under the nose of your conscience, then do you know what your conscience would tell you to do? It would tell you to withdraw your endorsement of Callahan, and the newspaper boys would be over here thicker'n blue bottle flies on a dead dog, and you could tell them all about you and your conscience. You wouldn't even have to back Masters. You and your conscience could just go off arm in arm and have a fine time telling each other how much you think of each other.
I have endorsed Callahan, the judge said. He didn't flicker.
I maybe could give you the dirt, the boss said speculatively. Callahan's been playing around for a long time, and he who touches pitch shall be defiled, and little boys just will walk barefoot in the cow pasture.
He looked up at Judge Irwin's face, squinting, studying it, cocking his own head to one side. The grandfather's clock in the corner of the room, I suddenly realized, wasn't getting any younger. It would drop out a tick, and then the tick would land inside my head like a rock dropped in a well, and the ripples would circle out and stop, and the tick would sink down the dark. For a piece of time which was not long or short, and might not even be time, there wouldn't be anything. Then the tock would drop down the well, and the ripples would circle out and finish.
This ends Disc 2. All the King's Men, Disc 3.
The boss quit studying Judge Irwin's face, which didn't show anything. He let himself sink back in the chair, shrugged his shoulders, and lifted the glass up for a drink. Then he said,
"Suit yourself, Judge. But you know there's another way to play it. Maybe somebody might give Callahan a little shovelful on somebody else, and Callahan might grow a conscience all of a sudden and repudiate his endorser. You know, when this conscience business starts, ain't no telling where it'll stop, and when you start the digging..."
"I'll thank you, sir."
Judge Irwin took a step toward the big chair, and his face wasn't the color of calf's liver now. It was long past that and streaked white back from the base of the jutting nose.
"I'll thank you, sir, to get out of that chair and get out of this house."
The boss didn't lift his head off the leather. He looked up at the judge, sweet and trusting, and then cocked his eyes over to me.
"Jack," he said, "you were sure right. The judge don't scare easy."
"Get out,"
the judge said, not loud this time.
"These old bones don't move fast," the boss murmured sadly. "But now I have tried to do my bounden duty, let me go."
Then he drained his glass, set it on the floor beside the chair, and rose. He stood in front of the judge, looking up at him, squinting again, cocking his head to one side again, like a farmer getting ready to buy a horse. I set my glass on the shelf of the bookcase behind me. I discovered that I hadn't touched it, not since the first sip. Well, to hell with it, I thought, and let it stand. Some nigger boy would get it in the morning. Then, as though he had decided against buying the horse, the boss shook his head and passed around the judge as though the judge weren't a man at all, or even a horse, as though he were the corner of a house or a tree, and headed for the hall door, putting his feet down slow and easy on the red carpet. No hurry. For a second or two, the judge didn't even move his head. Then he swung round and watched the boss going toward the door, and his eyes glittered up there in the shadow above the lamp.
The boss laid his hand on the doorknob, opened the door, and then, with his hand still on the knob, he looked back. "Well, Judge," he said, "more in pain than wrath I go. And if your conscience decides it could gag at Callahan, just let me know. In, of course," and he grinned, "a reasonable time." Then he looked over at me and said, "Let's haul ass, Jack," and started on down toward the front door, out of sight. Before I could get into low gear, the judge swung his face in my direction and focused his eyes on me, and his upper lip lifted under that nose to form a smile of somewhat massive irony, and he said, "Your employer is calling you, Mr. Burden." "I don't use any ear trumpet yet," I said, and pulled off toward the door and thought to myself, "Christ, Jack, you talk like a snot. Christ, you are a smart guy." I had just about made the door when he said, "I'm dining with your mother this week. Shall I tell her you still like your work?" Why don't he lay off, I thought, but he wouldn't, and that lip lifted up again. So I said, "Suit yourself, Judge, but if I were you, I wouldn't go around advertising this visit to anybody. In case you changed your mind, somebody might figure you had stooped to a low political deal with the boss in the dark of night." And I went out the door and down the hall and out the hall door and left it open but let the screen door slam. God damn him, why hadn't he laid off me? But he hadn't scared. We left the bay and lost the salt, sad, sweet, fishy smell of the tide lands out of our nostrils. We headed north again. It was darker now. The ground mist lay heavier on the fields, and in the dips of the road the mist frayed out over the slab and blunted the headlights. Now and then a pair of eyes would burn at us out of the dark ahead. I knew that they were the eyes of a cow, a poor, dear, stoic old cow with a cud, standing on the highway shoulder, for there wasn't any stock law, but her eyes burned at us out of the dark as though her skull were full of blazing molten metal like blood, and we could see inside the skull, into that bloody hot brightness, in that moment when the reflection was, right before we picked up her shape, which is so perfectly formed to be pelted with clods, and knew what she was, and knew that inside that unlovely, knotty head, there wasn't anything but a handful of coldly coagulated gray mess in which something slow happened as we went by. We were something slow happening inside the cold brain of a cow. That's what the cow would say, if she were a brass-bound idealist like little Jackie Burden. The boss said, "Well, Jackie, it looks like you got a job cut out for you." And I said, "Callahan?" And he said, "Nope, Irwin." And I said, "I don't reckon you'll find anything on Irwin." And he said, "You find it." We bored on into the dark for another 20 miles and 18 minutes. The ectoplasmic fingers of the mist reached out of the swamp, threading out from the blackness of the cypresses to snag us, but didn't have any luck. A possum came out of the swamp and started across the road and might have made it, too, if Sugar Boy hadn't been too quick for him. Sugar Boy just shaded the steering wheel delicately to the left, just a fraction. There wasn't even a jounce or twitch, but something thumped against the underside of the left front fender, and Sugar Boy said, "The b-b-b-bastard." Sugar Boy could thread a needle with that Cadillac. At about the end of that 18 minutes and 20 miles, I said, "But suppose I don't find anything before Election Day?" The boss said, "To hell with Election Day, I can deliver Master's prepaid special handling. But if it takes 10 years, you find it." We clocked off 5 miles more, and I said, "But suppose there isn't anything to find?" And the boss said, "There is always something." And I said, "Maybe not on the judge." And he said, "Man is conceived in sin and born in corruption, and he passeth from the stink of the deity to the stench of the shroud. There is always something."
2 miles more, and he said, "And make it stick." And that was all a good while ago. And Masters is dead now, as dead as a mackerel, but the boss was right, and he went to the Senate. And Callahan is not dead, but he has wished he were, no doubt, for he used up his luck a long time back, and being dead was not part of it. And Adam Stanton is dead now, too, who used to go fishing with me, and who lay on the sand in the hot sunshine with me and with Ann Stanton. And Judge Irwin is dead, who leaned toward me among the stems of the tall gray marsh grass in the gray, damp, wintry dawn, and said,
"You ought to have led that duck more, Jack. You gotta lead a duck, son."
And the boss is dead, who said to me, "And make it stick." Little Jackie made it stick, all right. Chapter 2. The last time I saw Mason City, I went up there in that big black Cadillac with the boss and the gang, and we burned up that new concrete slab, and it was a long time ago. Nearly 3 years, for it is now into 1939, but it seems like forever. But the first time I went up there, it was a lot longer time ago, back in 1922, and I went up there in my Model T, hanging onto the steering post to stay in the saddle when I side-slipped in the gray dust, which plumed out behind for a mile and settled on the cotton leaves to make them gray too, or when I hit a section of gravel, holding my jaws clamped tight to keep the vibration from the washboard from chipping the enamel off my teeth. You'll have to say this for the boss. When he got through, you could drive out for a breath of air and still keep your bridge work in place. But you couldn't that first time I went to Mason City. The managing editor of the Chronicle called me in and said, "Jack, get in your car and go up to Mason City and see who the hell that fella Stark is who thinks he's Jesus Christ scourging the money changers out of that shin plaster courthouse up there." "He married a school teacher," I said. "Well, it must have gone to his head," Jim Madison, who was managing editor of the Chronicle, said. "Does he think he is, the first one ever popped a school teacher?" "The bond issue was for building a schoolhouse," I said, "and it looks like Lucy figures they might keep some of it for that purpose." "Well, who the hell is Lucy?" "Lucy is the school teacher," I said. "She won't be a school teacher long," he said. "Not on the Mason County payroll if she keeps that up. Not if I know Mason County." "Lucy don't favor drinking either," I said. "Was it you or the other guy popped Lucy?" he demanded. "You know so much about Lucy." "I just know what Willie told me." "Who the hell is Willie?" "Willie's the fellow with the Christmas tie," I said. "He is Cousin Willie from the country. He's Willie Stark, the teacher's pet. And I met him in the back room of Slade's place a couple of months ago, and he told me Lucy didn't favor drinking. I'm just guessing about her not favoring stealing." "She doesn't favor Willie being county treasurer either," Jim Madison allowed, "if she's the one putting him up to what he's doing. Doesn't she know how they run things up in Mason County?" "They run 'em up there just like they run 'em down here," I said. "Yeah," Jim Madison said, and took the foul, chewed, and spit-bright butt of what had been a 2-bit cigar out of the corner of his mouth, and inspected it, and reached out at arm's length and let it fall into the big brass spittoon which stood on the clover-deep Kelly-green carpet which bloomed like an oasis of elegance in the 4 floors of squalor of the Chronicle building. He watched it fall and said again, "Yeah, but you leave down here and go on up there." So I went up to Mason City in the Model T, and kept my jaws clamped tight when I went over the washboard and hung to the steering post when I went over the side-slipping dust, and that was a very long time ago. I got to Mason City early in the afternoon and went to the Mason City Cafe, home-cooked meals for ladies and gents, facing the square, and sampled the mashed potatoes and fried ham and greens with pot liquor with one hand, while with the other I competed with 7 or 8 flies for the possession of a piece of custard pie. I went out into the street, where the dogs lay on the shady side under the corrugated iron awnings,
and walked down the block till I came to the harness shop. There was one vacant seat out front, so I said howdy-do and joined the club. I was the junior member by 40 years, but I thought I was going to have liver spots on my swollen old hands, crooked on the head of the hickory stick like the rest of 'em, before anybody was going to say anything. In a town like Mason City, the bench in front of the harness shop is, or was 20 years ago, before the concrete slab got laid down, the place where time gets tangled in its own feet and lies down like an old hound and gives up the struggle. It is a place where you sit down and wait for night to come and arteriosclerosis. It's the place the local undertaker looks at with confidence and thinks he's not going to starve as long as that much work is cut out for him. But if you're sitting on the bench in the middle of the afternoon in late August with the old ones, it doesn't seem that anything will ever come, not even your own funeral, and the sun beats down and the shadows don't move across the bright dust, which, if you stare at it long enough, seems to be full of glittering specks like quartz. The old ones sit there with their liver-spotted hands, crooked on the hickory sticks, and they emit a land of metaphysical effluvium by virtue of which your categories are altered. Time and motion cease to be. It's like sniffing ether, and everything is sweet and sad and far away. You sit there among the elder gods, disturbed by no sound except the slight rawl of the one who has asthma, and wait for them to lean from the Olympian and sunlit detachment and comment with their unenvious and foreknowing irony on the goings-on of the folks who are still snared in the toils of mortal compulsions. I seen Sim Saunders done built him a new barn. Then, yeah, some folks thinks they is made of money. And, yeah. So I sat there and waited. And one of them said it, and another one leaned and shifted the quid and answered, and the last one said, yeah. Then I waited again for a spell, for I knew my place in the picture, and then I said, they tell me there's going to be a new schoolhouse. Then I waited another spell while the words died away, and it was as though I hadn't said anything. Then one of them let the ambeer drop to the dry ground and touched the spot with the end of the hickory stick and said, yeah, and steam heat here tell. And number two, give them young'uns pneumony steam heat. And number three, yeah. And number four, if'n they get it built. I looked across the square at the painted clock face on the courthouse tower, which was the clock the old ones kept time by, and waited. Then I said, what's stopping 'em? And number one, stark, that's stark. And number two, yeah, that Willie Stark. And number three, too big for his britches. Gets in the courthouse and gets his front feet in the trough and gets too big for his britches. And number four, yeah. I waited, then I said, wants 'em to take the low bid, they tell me. And number one, yeah, wants 'em to take the low bid and get a passel of niggers in here. And number two, to put white folks out of work, building it. And number three, you want to work alongside a nigger, and especially him a strange nigger, building schoolhouse or back house, how so be it? And number four, and white folks needin' work? And number one, yeah. Yeah, I said to myself. So that's the tale. For Mason County is redneck country, and they don't like niggers, not strange niggers anyway, and they haven't got many of their own. How much could they save, I asked, taking the low bid. And number one, couldn't save enough to pay for bringing no passel of niggers in here. Putting white folks out of work, number two said. I waited till it was decent, then I got up and said, gotta be moving. Good afternoon, gentlemen. One of the old ones looked up at me as though I had just come and said, what you work at, boy? I don't,
I said. "Poorly?" he asked. "Not poorly," I said. "It's just I lack ambition." Which was God's truth, I reckoned, as I walked on down the street. I reckoned, too, that I had killed enough time, and I might as well go on to the courthouse and get my story in the way I was supposed to get it. All this sitting around in front of harness shops was not the way any newspaper man would go about getting his story. There isn't ever anything you get that way which you can put into a newspaper. So I went on over to the courthouse. Inside the courthouse, where the big hall was empty and shadowy, and the black oily floor was worn down to humps and ridges under your feet, and the air was dry and dusty, so that you felt in the stillness that you were breathing into yourself the last shrunk-up whispers still hanging in the air from all the talk, loud and little, there had been in there for 75 years. Well, inside there, just off the hall, I saw some men sitting in a room. Above the doorway there was a tin sign with the letters about faded off, but they still said, "Sheriff." I went into the room where the three men were cocked back in split-bottom chairs, and an electric fan set on top of the roll-top desk was burring away with little effect, and said howdy-do to the faces. The biggest face, which was round and red and had its feet cocked on the desk and its hands laid on its stomach, said howdy-do. I took a card out of my pocket and gave it to him. He looked at the card for a minute, holding it off near arm's length as though he were afraid it would spit in his eye. Then he turned it over and looked at the backside a minute till he was dead sure it was blank. Then he laid the hand with the card in it back down on his stomach, where it belonged, and looked at me. "You done come a piece," he said. "That's right," I said. "What you come for?" "To see what's going on about the schoolhouse," I said. "You come a piece," he said, "to stick your nose in somebody else's business." "That's right," I agreed cheerfully, "but my boss on the paper can't see it that way." "It ain't any of his business either." "No," I said, "but what's the ruckus about now I've come all that piece?" "It ain't any of my business. I'm the sheriff." "Well, sheriff," I said, "whose business is it?" "Them as is tendin' to it, if folks would quit messin' and let 'em." "Who is them?" "Commissioners," the sheriff said. "The county commissioners, the voters of Mason County, done elected to tend to their business and not take no buttin' in from nobody." "Yeah, sure, the commissioners. But who are they?" The sheriff's little wise eyes blinked at me a couple of times. Then he said, "The constable ought to lock you up for vagrancy." "Suits me," I said. "And the Chronicle would send up another boy to cover my case. And when the constable pinched him, the Chronicle would send up another one to cover that case, and after a while you'd get us all locked up, but it might get in the papers." The sheriff just lay there, and out of his big round face his little eyes blinked. Maybe I hadn't said anything. Maybe I wasn't there. "Who are the commissioners?" I said. "Or maybe they're hiding out?" "One of 'em is sitting right there," the sheriff said, and rolled his big round head on his shoulders to indicate one of the other fellows. When the head had fallen back into place, and his fingers had let go my card, which wafted down to the floor in the gentle breeze from the fan, the little eyes blinked again, and he seemed to sink below the surface of the roiled waters. He had done his best, and now he had passed the ball. "Are you a commissioner?" I asked the fella just indicated. He was just another fella, made in God's image, and wearing a white shirt with a ready-tied black bow tie and jean pants held up with web galluses. Town from the waist up, country from the waist down. Get both votes. "Yeah," he said. "He's the head man," another fella said, reverently. A little old squirt of a fella, with a bald, knotty old head and a face he himself couldn't recollect from one time he looked in the mirror to the next, the sort of a fella who hangs around and sits in a chair when the big boys leave one vacant and tries to buy his way into the game with a remark like the one he had just made. "You the chairman?" I asked the other fella.
Yeah?
He said. You mind telling me your name?
It ain't no secret,
he said.
It's Dolph Pillsbury.
Glad to know you, Mr. Pillsbury, I said and held out my hand. Not getting up, he took it as though I had offered him the business end of a cotton-mouth moccasin in shedding time. Mr. Pillsbury, I said, you're in a position to know the situation in regard to the schoolhouse contract. No doubt you're interested in having the truth of that situation made public.
There ain't any situation, Mr. Pillsbury said.
Maybe there isn't any situation, I said, but there's been a right smart racket.
Ain't any situation. Board meets and takes a bid what's been offered. J.H. Moore's bid, the fella's name.
Was that fella Moore's bid low?
Not exactly.
You mean it wasn't low?
Well,
Mr. Pillsbury said, and his face was shadowed by an expression which might have been caused by a gas pain.
Well, if and you want to put it that way.
All right, I said. Let's put it that way.
Now look a here.
And the shadow passed from Mr. Pillsbury's face, and he sat up in his chair as suddenly as though he had been stuck by a pin.
You talk like that, and ain't nothing done but legal. Ain't nobody can tell the board what bid to take. Anybody can come along and put in a little pissant bid, but the board don't have to take it, no siree. The board takes somebody can do the work right.
Who was it put the little pissant bid in?
Name of Jeffers,
Mr. Pillsbury said peevishly, as at an unpleasant recollection. Jeffers Construction? I asked.
Yeah.
What's wrong with Jeffers Construction?
The board picks a fella can do the work right, and it ain't nobody's business.
I took out my pencil and a pad of paper and wrote on it. Then I said to Mr. Pillsbury, "How's this?" And I began to read to him. Mr. Dolph Pillsbury, chairman of the Board of County Commissioners of Mason County, stated that the bid of J.H. Moore for the construction of the Mason County School was accepted, even though it was not the low bid, because the board wanted somebody, quote, who could do the work right, unquote. The low bid, which was submitted by the Jeffers Construction Company, was rejected, Mr. Pillsbury stated. Mr. Pillsbury stated further,
"Now, look a here."
Mr. Pillsbury was sitting very straight up, as though it were not a pin this time but a hot tenpenny and in the brown.
"Now, look a here. I didn't state nothing. You write it down and claim I stated it. Now, you look a here."
The sheriff heaved massively in the chair and fixed his gaze upon Mr. Pillsbury.
"Dolph," he said, "tell a bugger to get out of here." "I didn't state nothing," Dolph said, "and you get out."
"Sure," I said, and put the pad in my pocket, "but maybe you can kindly tell me where Mr. Stark is."
"I knowed it."
The sheriff exploded and dropped his feet off the desk with a noise like a brick chimney falling and heaved up in the chair and glared apoplectically at me.
"That Stark, I knowed it was that Stark."
"What's wrong with Stark?" I asked.
"Jesus God!"
roared the sheriff, and his face went purple with the congestion of language which couldn't get out.
"He's biggity, that's what he is," Mr. Dolph Pillsbury offered. "Gets in the courthouse and gets biggity. He's a nigger lover,"
the little old bald, knotty-headed fellow submitted.
"And him,
Mr. Pillsbury pointed at me with an air of revelation.
"I bet he's a nigger lover coming up here and sashaying round. I bet he—"
"No sale," I said. "I like mine vanilla. But now you've raised the subject, what's nigger loving got to do with it?"
"Well, that's it,"
Mr. Pillsbury exclaimed, like the man overboard seizing the plank. "The Jeffers Construction now, they—"
"You, Dolph," the sheriff bellowed at him. "Why don't you shut up and tell him to get out?"
"Get out," Mr. Pillsbury said to me, obediently but without great vigor.
"Sure,"
I replied and went out and walked down the hall. They ain't real, I thought as I walked down the hall, nary one. But I knew they were. You come into a strange place, into a town like Mason City, and they don't seem real, But you know they are. You know they went wading in the creek when they were kids, and when they were bigger they used to go out about sunset and lean on the back fence and look across the country at the sky and not know what was happening inside them, or whether they were happy or sad. And when they got grown, they slept with their wives and tickled their babies to make them laugh, and went to work in the morning and didn't know what they wanted, but had their reasons for doing things and wanted to do good things because they always gave good reasons for the things they did. And then, when they got old, they lost their reasons for doing anything and sat on the bench in front of the harness shop and had words for the reasons other people had, but had forgotten what the reasons were. And then they will lie in bed some morning, just before day, and look up at the ceiling they can scarcely see because the lamp is shaded with a pinned-on newspaper, and they don't recognize the faces around the bed anymore because the room is full of smoke or fog, and it makes their eyes burn and gets in the throat. Oh, they're real, all right. And it may be the reason they don't seem real to you is that you aren't very real yourself. But by that time I was standing in front of a door at one end of the cross hall and was looking up at another tin sign and knew from it that I had arrived at the one-man leper colony of Mason City. The leper was sitting in the room, not doing anything, all by himself. There wasn't anybody to sit and spit and jaw with him under his electric fan. "Hello," I said, and he looked up at me as though I were a spook and the word I had used were in a foreign language. He didn't answer me right off, and I figured he was like one of those fellas who gets marooned on a desert island for 20 years, and when the longboat is beached and the jolly tars leap out on the sand and ask him who the hell he is, he can't say a word because his tongue is so rusty. Well, Willie wasn't that bad off, for he finally managed to say hello, and that he remembered me from our meeting in Slade's place a few months back, and to ask me what I wanted. I told him, and he grinned a grin more wistful than happy, and asked me why I wanted to know. "The editor told me to find out," I said, "and why he wants me to find out, only God knows. Maybe it's because it's news." That seemed to be enough to satisfy him, so I didn't tell him that beyond my boss, the managing editor, there was a great high world of reasons, but to a fellow like me, down in the ditch, it was a world of flickering, diaphanous spirit wings and faint angel voices I didn't always savvy and stellar influences. "I reckon it is news," Willie allowed. "What's been going on around here?" "I don't mind telling you," he said. He began telling me, and he finished telling me about 11 o'clock that night with Lucy Stark, after she had put the kid to bed, and me sitting with him in the parlor out at his pappy's place, where he had asked me to spend the night, and where he and Lucy ordinarily lived in the summer, and where they were going to live that winter, too, instead of in a room in town, because Lucy had just been fired from her teaching job for the coming year, and there wasn't any reason to be in town and be spending good money for rent. And there was very likely to be another reason for there not being any reason to stay in town, for Willie was coming up for re-election, and his chances looked about as good as the chances of a flea making a living off a carved marble lion on a monument. He had only got the job in the first place, he told me, because Dolph Pillsbury, the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners, was a sort of second-hand relative of old Mr. Stark, by marriage or something, and Pillsbury had had a falling out with the other fellow who wanted to be treasurer. Pillsbury about ran the county, he and the sheriff, and he was sick of Willie. So Willie was on his way out, and Lucy was already out. "And I don't care if I am," Lucy Stark said, sitting there in the parlor, sewing by the lamp on the table where the big Bible and the plush-bound album were. "I don't care a bit if they won't let me teach anymore. I taught 6 years, counting that term I was out and having little Tommy, and nobody ever said I wasn't all right, but now they write me a letter and say there are complaints about my work and I don't show a spirit of cooperation." She lifted her sewing and bit off the thread in the way women do to make your flesh crawl. When she leaned over, the light hit her hair to show up the auburn luster lurking in the brown, which the operator of the recently established Mason City beauty shop hadn't been entirely able to burn out with the curling tongs when she gave the Marcel treatment. It was too bad about Lucy's hair, even if the luster was still there. She was still girlish then, About 25, but not looking it, with a nice little waist coming straight up out of the satisfactory and unmeager hips, and a nice little pair of ankles crossed in front of the chair, and her face was girlish, with soft, soothing contours and large, deep brown eyes, the kind that makes you think of telling secrets in the gloaming over a garden gate when the lilacs are in bloom along the picket fence of the old homestead. But her hair was cut off at about neck level, and marcelled the way they did it back then, which was a shame because the face she had was the kind that demanded to be framed by a wealth of long and lustrous dusky tresses tangled on the snow-white pillow. She must have had plenty of hair, too, before the massacre. "But I don't care," she said, and lifted her head out of the light. "I don't want to teach in a schoolhouse they build just so somebody can steal some money. And Willie doesn't want to be treasurer either if he has to associate with those dishonest people." "I'm going to run," Willie said glumly. "They can't keep me from running."
"You can give a lot more time to studying your law books," she said to him, "when you aren't in town all the time."
"I'm going to run," he repeated, and jerked his head with that sharp motion he had to get the lock of hair out of his eyes. "I'm going to run," he repeated again, as though he weren't talking to Lucy or to me, but to the wide sweet air or God Almighty. "If I don't get a single goddamn vote." Well, he did run when the time came, and he got more than one vote, but not many more, and Mr. Dolph Pillsbury and his pals won that round. The fellow who was elected against Willie that fall didn't hang his hat up in the office before he had signed the check for the advance payment to J.H. Moore, and J.H. Moore built the schoolhouse. But that's getting ahead of the story. The story, as Willie told it, was this. The Jeffers Construction Company had low bid at $142,000. But there were two more bids in between the Jeffers bid and the Moore bid, which was $165,000 and a lot of nickels and dimes. But when Willie kicked about the Moore business, Pillsbury started the nigger business. Jeffers was a big-time contractor from the south of the state, and he used a lot of Negro bricklayers and plasterers and carpenters in some of his crews. Pillsbury started howling that Jeffers would bring in a lot of Negroes, and Mason County, as I said, is redneck country. And worse, some of the Negroes would be getting better pay, being skilled laborers, than the men he would pick up around Mason City for some of the work. Pillsbury kept the pot boiling. He kept it boiling so well that the public overlooked the fact that there were two bids in between Jeffers and Moore, and the fact that Pillsbury had a brother-in-law who had a brick kiln in which Moore had an interest, and that in the not-distant past, a lot of the bricks had been declared rotten by the building inspector on a state job and had been refused, and there had been a lawsuit, and that as sure as God made little green apples with worms in them, bricks from the same kiln would be used in the schoolhouse. The kiln owned by Moore and Pillsbury's brother-in-law used convict labor from the state pen and got it cheap, for the brother-in-law had some tie well up in the system. In fact, as I picked up later, the tie was so good that that building inspector who squawked about the bricks on the state job got thrown out, but I never knew whether he was honest or just ill-informed. Willie didn't have any luck bucking Pillsbury and the sheriff. There was an anti-Pillsbury faction, but it didn't amount to much, and Willie didn't add to its numbers. Willie went out and buttonholed folks on the street and tried to explain things to them. You could see Willie standing on a street corner, sweating through his seersucker suit with his hair down in his eyes, holding an old envelope in one hand and a pencil in the other, working out figures to explain what he was squawking about. But folks don't listen to you when your voice is low and patient, and you stop them in the hot sun and make them do arithmetic. Willie tried to get the Mason County Messenger to print something, but they wouldn't. Then he wrote up a long statement of the case as he saw it about the bids and tried to get the Messenger to print it on handbills in their job printing shop, paid for, but they wouldn't do it. So Willie had to go to the city to get the work done. He came back with his handbills and hired a couple of kids to tote them from house to house in town. But the folks of one of the kids made him stop as soon as they found out, and when the other kid didn't stop, some big boys beat him up. So Willie toted them around himself, over town, from house to house, carrying them in an old satchel, the kind school kids use, and knocked on the door and then tipped his hat when the lady of the house came.
but most of the time she didn't come. There'd be a rustle of a window shade inside, but nobody would come. So Willie would stick